Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Wednesday edition of The Opening Bell. For those of you who think that we're on the verge of an energy revolution, think again. It's going to take more than solar panels, windmills, and batteries. At least that's what a new report authored by our next guest says. Mark Mills is Senior Fellow on Energy and Technology Policy at the Manhattan Institute and joins us this morning. Good morning. Let's begin with the title of the report, because I think it speaks volumes to the conversation we're going to have this morning. The New Energy Economy, an Exercise in Magical Thinking. I think most of us are trying to think optimistically about new ways to find new energy sources and combat climate change. But why are we all thinking a little over our skis about this?
The why and the fact that it is over the skis are two different questions. One is physics. The other is probably the domain of psychology, which I'm happy to talk about. Why do we think that? But my point really on the paper is not that we don't have more windmills and solar arrays, which people like and think we should have more of, and that there won't be more of them and more Teslas and electric cars in the future. The magical thinking is the thought and the proposal, which is not a new one, the proposal that we can change all our energy systems over from using hydrocarbons, oil, gas, and coal, to using wind, solar, and batteries. The idea that that's possible, in fact, is magical thinking. Not using more of them, but using them as our primary sources of energy, some kind of energy tech revolution. There is no revolution in energy. There's none that has happened in a half a century. We've got nothing new, and that's the challenge, is the thought that it seems to be new is, in fact, magical thinking. It's not.
Well, and then the idea, too, that the stuff that we do have, the wind, the solar, these batteries, all of this stuff, the technology has not gotten to the point where any one of them or all of them could handle our system now and what we need. Give us a sense of the physics of the two, if you could, because I know there's a wonderful comparison there about oil versus or natural gas versus batteries, and I think that's sort of illustrative of what we're talking about.
Well, exactly. I mean, the issue here is not one of things. We haven't made tremendous improvements in wind and solar and batteries. Of course, they've gotten much better. The question is, are they good enough to become primary sources of energy, and can they ever get good enough? And we know they can't. Here's how you could take a look at it. If we start building a lot more wind and solar arrays today to make electricity, we just start with the fact that for every $1 million that we spend on, say, a solar or wind array, you can produce electricity. In over 30 years, you get about 50 million kilowatt hours of electricity. 50 million kilowatt hours, you know, for $1 million of capital and hardware. The problem is the same $1 million in capital to build hardware put into a shale well will get you 300 million kilowatt hours over the same 30 years. So that's six times more energy produced for the same money spent. The difference between the two is anchored in the physics of the two technologies. There's much higher energy density in oil than there is in wind and solar. Wind and solar are diffuse. If they weren't diffuse, there'd be no light on. There'd be no life on Earth. They're diffuse energy forms. And here's another way to think of it. If we said, look, they're going to get cheaper. I want to use more of them anyway, and I'm going to run America's electric grid on wind and solar. Okay, we can put more wind and solar on the grid. Right now, about 2% of America's, well, 3% actually, 3% of America's energy come from wind and solar. The rest come primarily from hydrocarbons. But if we keep increasing it, and we say, well, look, I'm going to use all that, and when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine, I'll just use batteries to make sure I keep everything lit, home, businesses, the internet. Okay, we don't have to know anything about the cost of the batteries. We just have to answer the question, which is an arithmetic question. How many batteries do I need? So here's a simple fact. The world's biggest lithium battery factory is in Nevada, built by Elon Musk, called the Gigafactory. It's an enormous battery factory. It would take 1,000 years of the output from that factory to make enough batteries that can store 2 days' worth of U.S. electric demand. And you have to store at least 2 days of electric demand at any given time. In fact, we store the equivalent of a month's worth at any given time in the form of fuel, because you can have long periods of time with very little sun and almost no wind. So that's 1,000 1,000 years from one factory, and it's the world's biggest factory. Even if those batteries were cheap, this would be an astonishingly difficult problem to solve.
People always say, well, it's I guess it's Moore's Law. We should think of how the computer has advanced so quickly and mobile phones have advanced so quickly. Why can't that be the same with the technology we're talking about for energy? Why is that impossible?
Well, this is the psychology question you started with. You know, why do people think that we can make wind turbines and batteries so much better? They think that. It's not an unreasonable thought when you look at how much better computers have gotten in the last 3 decades. I mean, look, the computer that's in everybody's hands or pocket or purse, that's a million times smaller than an IBM mainframe of 1980, and it's billion times cheaper per unit of computing power, and it's an unbelievable engineering accomplishment. And so you just say, why can't I just do that with, say, solar or batteries? Well, the physics of information production is not the same as the physics of energy production. You can do magic things with code when you want to just determine whether a bit exists or not. You can't do anything magic with growing a ton of food or moving a ton of people, making a ton of food, steel or silicon. These are bound by the laws of physics. If solar arrays could follow Moore's Law, the computing improvements, then you could build a solar panel that would be the size of a postage stamp, and it would power the Empire State Building forever. But that will never happen in the universe we live in. It just can't happen. The physics doesn't exist.
Would it take an alien civilization to suddenly appear on Earth with some strange, crazy new technology to advance us to the place where some of the proponents of the Green New Deal and some of the other high-tech energy wave of the future want us to be? Would it take something like that? Is that what we're saying?
Well, actually, the aliens probably have physics we don't have. Certainly, if they could get here, they'd have physics we don't have. So actually, what it would take is a refocus of our spending. So I am an optimist that we'll find new physics and new classes of physical chemistry that could do things that people want to have happen, what seem like magic today. The problem is you don't get new physics and new technology by spending money on yesterday's stuff. It's kind of like saying, did the Internet come from subsidizing the rotary dial-up phone? Did the car come from subsidizing steam engines on trains? I mean, you can go down a long list of things that we think are revolutionary and were, but they came from fundamental and profound new innovations. And the way we get that, aliens could bring it to us, but more realistically, what we would do is fund basic research in material science, physics, chemistry. If we fund that, in due course, we will find a new magic and new physics and chemistry and new kinds of energy production. That's inevitable, in fact. But it unfortunately won't happen overnight. We can't predict where it'll happen. And in the meantime, we have to live with what we got, which is primarily a hydrocarbon-fueled world. It happens to be the cheapest, easiest, most effective way to fuel 85% of what society needs.
Some other countries are a little further down the road than we are in terms of some of these new energy technologies. I'm thinking of Germany and Great Britain. Are there any lessons that we can see from those countries that we can use here as we move forward down the road?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's first stipulating that we in America tend to ignore lessons learned in other countries because we're very focused on our continent. But it would be nice if we learned the lesson. What we do know is that as those countries have increased their share of wind and solar on their electric grids, they've seen the cost of electricity rise. It's worth noting that the cost of electricity in places like Germany and the United Kingdom are 200 to 300% more, not 20% more, like 200 to 300% more than in America. And that correlation is one-to-one linked to increasing the amount of wind and solar on those grids. That's because, as I pointed out at the outset, the inherent costs of those technologies are higher. They also have spillover costs. Somebody's making the electricity when the wind's not blowing and the sun's not shining. Those power systems cost more when they're used less often. So the whole system essentially has to be doubled. So even if the wind and solar costs the same as conventional energy, you're effectively building two grids. You know, the grid you need all the time, which you only use sometimes, and the grid that you use sometimes, you need all the time, the wind solar grid. So you've just doubled the cost of your infrastructure. It's not a good solution. It's extremely expensive. Small amounts of it on a percentage basis are perfectly fine, and I think we'll see lots more. The small amounts globally are very big business. I mean, the world's a big place.
after reading your report, I am a little less hopeful that we'll get there in my lifetime and maybe find the answers to some of this, unless there's, you mentioned, there's some magical thing that happens. How do we deal with that part of this then? If we're a little pessimistic about the future, if we have these huge challenges, is it okay to dream with the Green New Deal and other initiatives like that, or how do we be hopeful?
Well, first, I'm an optimist. I'm not worried. I think the idea that we should be pessimistic about energy sources comes from the fact that people are pessimistic about our ability to have technology deal with the consequences of things that we do to keep society running. You know, if we have events from weather, if we have things that people believe are happening because the climate is changing, the solution is to develop technologies for resilience. In fact, that is a very common proposal globally in many environmental communities. It's not satisfactory in the sense that you want to have a magic solution to stop using hydrocarbons, even if you thought we had to. My point is that we aren't going to. We can't. Is there anything wrong with sort of dreaming and we should have something different? Of course not. I mean, from dreams come magical things eventually. The point I'm making is that the dreams don't lead to real technology in timeframes that are meaningful. Look, Jules Verne dreamed about going to the moon in 1865 when he published probably the first science fiction book. And he even thought, you know, he lived at a time of incredible technology change. It was the first telecommunications revolution, you know, telegraphy and the cable system. It was the first time humanity had moved information at the speed of light. In all of history, up till then, it was the speed of a horse. So it was a very exciting time. So he imagined, you know, we'd go to the moon soon. It took 100 years before we had the technology and science to get a few men on the moon a few dozen times. I mean, that's a century, not weeks, not months, not decades. That's the kind of aspiration that is being proposed for radically changing our energy system. It's the equivalent of putting all of humanity on the moon. That's not going to happen with the science and engineering we have today. So one day, yeah, sure. 10 years, 20 years, not a chance.
Yeah, and it begs the question, does planet Earth have another 100 years for us to reach that level?
Well, the carrying capacity of the planet Earth, this is where we're back to arithmetical sort of myopia. People have been told that the Earth is being taxed by the capacity to handle humanity. But this is a very old debate we've been having, since the time of Malthus. This is a the end of humanity, because there's too many of us consuming too many things. The Malthusian view of the world is seductive to a lot of people. It's been proven to be wrong by the passage of time. We still have a lot of people think the Earth can't produce enough stuff and be resilient enough to put up with humanity. I don't think if you spend time on this, you find any evidence for that being true, despite lots of claims that it's true. We have an astonishing capacity to reduce our environmental impacts with technology, using magic technology, but not changing the energy sources that we're using.
Well, Mr. Mills, thank you for sharing this with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mark Mills is Senior Fellow and on Energy and Technology Policy at the Manhattan Institute, where you can find the new report that he's the author of at the Manhattan Institute website, which is manhattan-institute.org. Again, manhattan-institute.org.